Next on Making Waves, we bring you EcoTalk, featuring Larry David of Seinfeld fame, explaining how he became an eco-activist.
Welcome back to EcoTalk, and thanks for staying with us all hour. We have a treat to reward you today as part of our collaboration with the Natural Resources Defense Council. It's From Earth to America, the TBS comedy show produced by NRDC trustee Lori David, and was on television last November. Here is Lori's husband, Larry, of Curb Your Enthusiasm and Seinfeld fame, explaining how and why he became an eco-activist.
Good evening. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I stand before you tonight... a new man. All right, that's being a little optimistic. But I say that because after a lifetime of indifference to nature, I have changed. I am now a full-fledged, committed activist. How could such a transformation take place? How did I go from being Larry David, radical narcissist, to Larry David, radical environmentalist? Let me give you some background. I grew up in Brooklyn. Of all the wonders and pleasures that exist in nature, none of them could be found in Brooklyn. The only grass I ever saw was on the divider of the Belt Parkway. There were no flowers, just artificial ones. Every apartment had artificial flowers. People took great pride in their artificial flowers. And fruit, let's not leave out the fruit. Anything fake, we love good fake things. The greatest compliment you could give somebody was to mistakenly pick up a piece of their artificial fruit and take a bite out of it. That made their day. But I couldn't smell a real flower anyway. I was born with the ability to only smell disgusting things. I never smell anything pleasant, ever. You can shove a lilac up my nose and I wouldn't smell it. But urine and BO I can smell from 3 blocks away. And Brooklyn was not wanting for disgusting odors. Bus fumes, garbage, cigarette smoke. Everybody in Brooklyn smoked, even 9-year-olds. The whole borough was hacking and coughing and spitting. There was phlegm everywhere. It was flying in you from every direction, out of windows, cars, anywhere you walked. You had to keep ducking so you wouldn't get hit. It was like a shooting gallery. And of course, needless to say, there were no animals in my life. My mother hated animals. All of them. If she had her way, she would kill every living animal on the planet. She looked at extinction as a good thing. When an animal was put on the endangered species list, she went out and got drunk. Let them all die. Who needs them? What good are they doing? There was nothing in nature we appreciated. Sunsets were mocked. Anyway, whatever harm's been done to the environment, and I know there's been a lot, it's never really affected me personally in any way. That is, until a few months ago. The first thing that happened was I noticed something on my face, and it turned out to be a benign skin cancer, which was caused by ozone depletion on me. All right, you know, it was benign. Of course, when people noticed the bandage and asked me what happened, you know, I told them it was cancer. I played it up a bit. It's the first time anyone's felt sorry for me since they published my income 8 years ago. When you have money, the only way you can get any sympathy at all is to say you have cancer. You can lose a limb, no one would care. Only when they know you're going to die do you get anyone feeling sorry for you. And even then, some people don't. So I had the skin cancer. Okay, it was benign. They took it off. Not terrible. I'm okay. My life goes on. But then, a few weeks after that, I was reading the newspaper when something caught my eye. And what I read has changed my life and brought me to this stage tonight. I'll sum it up in one word. Tuna. That's right, my friends. Tuna. I read that there's mercury in tuna, and it's just not safe to eat it anymore. Oh, sure, there's mercury in a lot of other fish. But I don't care about those other fish. I care about tuna. What am I supposed to have for lunch? I've been ordering tuna for lunch every day since I was 10 years old. This has been the only decision of my life that I can make every day with any degree of certainty and feel good about it. And I was a tuna connoisseur. I could tell the difference between Bumblebee and Starkist. I made my own, me, in the kitchen, chopping and dicing. I have my own recipe with pickles and peppers. So I appeal to all of you to do whatever you can to clean up this planet. So one day, in the not too distant future, I can once again sit down at a restaurant and say, a tuna sandwich on whole wheat toast with lettuce and tomato. Hold the mayo.
That is America's cutest curmudgeon, Larry David. We invite you to go to our website, which can be found at www.ecotalk.net.
Now for Dave Lippman with You Can't Grow a Forest.
Footfall in the forest like a dream. Stop and splash at every stream. So full of wonder, make you wanna scream. The inner city, it ain't making a pilgrimage to the creek. I could be human in another week in this place. All the while I seek to find what I at every waterfall. Nobody can hear me here, so I call. Wouldn't it be wonderful if this was all? Please don't build a mall here. Running broken trails just like a deer. All they wishing you were here. Hoping no one else will come near. Wanna tumble down a mountainside. Make you wanna go along for the ride. You can feel the spirit as it hits its stride. It's different here. Different here. Sucking the sharp air of the mountain. So many kinds of birds, I stop counting. I'm drinking from my youth fountain. Soda fountain, it ain't. Found myself to feel a bit of bliss. Shaking and shouting, I want more of this. All the times I sin, it's been real. This is the part I forgot to be. Bend in the road, bend in the river. If your mother gives you love, return what do you give her? I haven't been faithful, dear God. What have I done? Out onto the road, out of the woods, search of the sun. Need a little pain, need a little rain. Forest is a world all its own. You can feel it sighing as the sun goes down. Like a deer, only wishing you were here. hoping no one else will come near. Moss and lichen over a sylvan stream, blue wildflowers in a field of green. Why would anyone want to do you harm? Can't grow a forest in a tree farm.
That was You Can't Grow a Forest by Dave Littman. Dave will be giving a concert on Tuesday, May 2nd at 7 p.m. at South Church, 292 State Street, Portsmouth. For more information, contact info@seacoastpeacerespons.org or call 603-749-9159. Don't miss it. You're listening to Making Waves. Next, we bring you EcoShock Features from Vancouver, British Columbia, with The Tale of an Autoholic.
The National Weather Service reported the Springfield Twister was the biggest storm to pass through central Illinois in a decade.
The West Texas wildfires have scorched so much land that it's like watching more than half of Rhode Island burn.
Biggest one I've ever seen.
I love to drive. You could say I'm an autoholic. My life began in a car, so Dad tells me. I discovered sex in the back seat too. Made my own kid there. I may die out on the road. When things get boring, I drive around looking for something else. And if it's no good here, I go there. Too hot? I'll just go north into the hills. Too cold? Off south, just like the birds. Sometimes, I don't even know why I'm going. I'm just out there on the road, rambling around. I've just got to get out there and drive, maybe for a day or two, and see some country, some trees. I need to see nature. I've worked in vehicles and slept in them, even lived in one. Can't count all the hours I've just waited somewhere with the motor running, for red light, for traffic to move, for somebody to come out, for anything. Who even hears the motor running there under your thoughts? Vibration is good, moves the blood around. We don't even smell these engines unless something's broken. I've driven them all. Motorcycles, three-wheelers, minis, SUVs, compacts, pickups. A limousine, a truck, tractors, golf carts, you name it. If it's got a motor, that's good for me. And the power, the roar, the jolt of energy, the thrill of speed. I've got this armored steel that can run away, or run over, or damn near fly. My ride talks for me, tells you who I am. Without it, I'd just be a naked little animal. Out there in the rain and snow, like a snail without a shell. Likely I wouldn't kill for fuel, but my taxes pay for soldiers who will, by God. Gotta have gas. And if by accident I had to run over some kid, heaven forbid, or some old fart, I may lose my license for a little while, but I'll keep driving. We all need to get around. Okay, the weather is getting really weird. You never know what might happen. If this place floods or burns, I'll toss my stuff in here and go somewhere better. I'm not walking around like a loser. Notice anybody else getting off the road? Not likely. On my dying day, when I go, it'll be sitting upright behind the wheel. Check out Radio EcoShock, the planet's only all-environment radio station at www.ecoshock.org.
Today, on Making Waves People's History section, we hear from Michael Parenti through the LA Sound Posse. He speaks about the myth of underdevelopment.
This is Radio Truth, a series of commentaries by Dr. Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is an activist and internationally known award-winning author and scholar. His recent books include The Assassination of Julius Caesar and Super Patriotism. His latest book, The Culture Struggle, will be released in November 2005. For further information, please visit his website, michaelparenti.org.
The myth of underdevelopment. Why are Asia, Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America, those areas known as the Third World, why are they so much poorer than Europe, North America, and Japan? When I was a kid, I heard that these poor regions were poor because of their climate. It was just so hot and nobody could get to do anything, and people were really lazy. In fact, the climate in many of these areas is beautiful, even when it's severe and people work very hard. None of them are lazy. I also heard that these poor populations have too many children, that they're backward in their cultures and just too easygoing. You know, everything was mañana, mañana. In fact, these countries were very, very advanced cultures, many of them. They didn't really have too many children, or let's say the children were not the cause of their poverty, but a result of the poverty. And in fact, these areas are not poor, they're rich, rich in resources. This explains why Walter Rodney titled his book, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. That is, he used the word underdeveloped as a verb. In country after country, when European and North American investment came in, the people did not become more prosperous, they ended up becoming poorer. This was true in Argentina, Brazil, North Africa, Southwest Africa, Vietnam. You can go all over the world and you'll find that whenever the foreign investors came in, they made money for themselves and the people ended up poorer, their resources depleted, their environment destroyed, and their futures also destroyed. The Third World is poor because it's been expropriated for centuries by the imperial interests of Europe, North America, and Japan. So underdevelopment really isn't an original historical condition. Underdevelopment is the result of over-exploitation. For centuries, Asia, Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America have had their lands plundered. Their markets have been monopolized, their populations dislocated, decimated, overworked and underpaid when they could get work. So what we really have is not underdevelopment, but a historically imposed maldevelopment. You have in many of these countries superhighways that go from the latifundia and the mines to the ports, but you have no roads for the people up in the backcountry so that they might be able to see a doctor or a teacher or something. You have in many of these countries exquisite plastic surgery clinics for the rich, but no hospitals for the poor. You have luxury high-rises in many of these countries, in their cities, with luxury offices and all that stuff. And meanwhile, the ordinary people live in shanty towns. You have enormous wealth in the form of export crops and export natural resources, and yet you have domestic poverty and the ruination of local farming and the ruination of local production. So what's called the developing nations really aren't developing. They're declining more and more. After the Cold War, there have been cutbacks in aid. No more developing. Now they're called failed nations. What is a failed nation? It's a nation that has been crushed by these dominant investment interests. The goal today is the third worldization of the entire world, including the United States itself. So what's called underdevelopment is not a neutral, natural phenomenon. It is historically linked to another historical global phenomenon, and that is called imperialism. This is Michael Parenti for Radio Truth.
This commentary was produced by the LA Sound Posse and may be freely copied and distributed. You can find us on the web at lasoundposse.org. The music was Flute Medicine by Synth.
You're listening to Making Waves. And now we bring you Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. Kurt Gottfried, chairman of the Union of Concerned Scientists, who assesses the consequences of a U.S. attack on Iran using tactical nuclear weapons. Investigative reporter Robert Parry, who examines the legal jeopardy that President Bush and Vice President Cheney may face as a result of their efforts to discredit administration critic Joseph Wilson. And Anita Dench, research director of the National Priorities Project, who explains where U.S. federal tax dollars are spent on both military and non-military programs. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The embattled regime of Chad President Idriss Deby has cut off diplomatic relations with neighboring Sudan after a failed rebel attack in the capital city of N'Djamena. Although rich in oil, Chad is currently ranked in the bottom five out of almost 180 nations, according to the United Nations. The government of Chad has threatened to close its borders with Sudan and expel the Darfur refugees. According to the BBC, the rebel group United Front for Change set up bases in Darfur and staged attacks from there. In Sudan, over 2 million villagers have fled their homes in Darfur as a result of a terror campaign by pro-Sudanese paramilitary groups known as the Janjaweed. 400,000 people have died in the three-year conflict. In recent weeks, the militias have begun attacking refugee camps in Chad. Chad is also in a battle with the World Bank over control of oil revenue from the recently opened Chad-Cameroon pipeline. The World Bank froze development funds after Chad repealed a law directing oil revenue to aid the poor. President Deby is now using these funds to pay for overall government services, including bolstering the military to protect his embattled regime. The Guardian newspaper reports the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, and the World Health Organization, the WHO, are ignoring evidence of thousands of new cancer cases caused by the Chernobyl nuclear power plant accident 20 years ago. New studies commissioned by European legislators, Greenpeace International, and medical foundations in Ukraine and Western Europe project over 30,000 people will develop cancer from the 1986 nuclear accident and related radiation exposure. At least 500,000 people or more may have died from the catastrophe, out of the 2 million who have already been classified as victims of Chernobyl. But the IAEA and WHO are sticking with lower fatality rates. The UN agencies say only 50 deaths can be directly linked to the 1986 accident near Kiev in the Ukraine, and an additional 4,000 people could die from radiation exposure. Nikolai Omelianets of Ukraine's National Commission on Radiation counters that new studies show nearly 35,000 people who helped clean up the Chernobyl site have since died. Reports indicate death rates from cancer were three times as high in these people than the general population. The American Prospect magazine reports there's a simple solution to fix the massive problems with Plan D, the Bush administration's Medicare drug plan. Simply bar the participation of private insurance companies in the Medicare system. The magazine suggests charging a small copayment for drugs and letting the federal government negotiate directly with drug companies for bulk discounts, like the Veterans Administration does. Advocates say this plan would pay for itself, but few leading Democrats on Capitol Hill are embracing it. Many top Senate Democrats voted for the Medicare drug benefit bill and are reluctant to reverse course. A study by economist Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research says getting rid of private insurance vendors and negotiating directly with drug companies over discounts would save $600 billion, enough to pay for the drug benefit. Currently, the VA pays 48% less for heavily used prescription drugs than the lowest cost private Medicare plan. Progressives are eager to push to make the drug benefit a successful publicly run program. But if nothing changes in Washington, private drug companies have 3 years to make their already flawed Medicare drug plan work. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
News reports by Seymour Hersh and other media outlets that the U.S. is planning for an attack against Iran's nuclear research facilities included the prospect that the Bush administration was considering the use of tactical nuclear weapons to destroy underground bunkers. While the story made headlines across the world, much of the reporting on this issue within the United States had a kind of unconcerned tone and avoided looking into the grave consequences of their use. The U.S. is the only nation in the world to have ever used nuclear weapons when it attacked the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the conclusion of World War II. But apart from the deployment of thousands of nuclear missiles in threat of mutual annihilation used as a deterrent during the Cold War with the Soviet Union, successive American governments have rarely used the threat of atomic attack as part of the nation's military doctrine. But since coming into office, President Bush has pursued funding for the development of a new class of battlefield nuclear weapons while lowering the threshold for their use. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Kurt Gottfried, chairman of the Union of Concerned Scientists and emeritus professor of physics at Cornell University, about U.S. planning for the use of nuclear weapons against Iran. Gottfried warns of the incentive such threats provide weaker nations to obtain nuclear weapons and the massive casualties that could result from a limited nuclear attack.
There's clearly a lot of detailed investigation behind those articles, so I think they have to be taken quite seriously. That doesn't mean that we're about to see war against Iran, but I think the planning surely is there. That it contains a nuclear component is not really surprising. That doesn't mean it will be used, but that the planning contains nuclear planning is also not surprising because the administration has made it quite clear since coming to office 6 years ago now that they consider nuclear weapons as a much more usable means for military purposes than previous administrations of either party. They conducted a nuclear posture review on coming into office. They have stated very clearly in testimony to the Senate Armed Services Committee, on the one hand, they want to reduce the size of the stockpile, which I think they are trying to do, that they no longer consider Russia as a primary enemy. But on the other hand, they've also greatly increased the number of scenarios in which they're willing to think about nuclear weapons. Before that, and especially during the Cold War, it was just assumed that nuclear weapons were weapons of last resort, weapons to be used when the survival of the United States is at stake. And they have really taken the end of the Cold War to mean that nuclear weapons are more usable than they were when one had to worry about a Soviet response or Soviet threat, even as a first attack on us. It's also clear that the threat of nuclear weapons is being conveyed by these, presumably, some of these things that Hersh reports about are purposeful leaks in order to frighten Iran.
We haven't really had a national debate in the United States about the use of tactical or battlefield nuclear weapons such as being talked about here in these articles. But what can you tell our listeners about the repercussions on the ground for the people of Iran, let's say, if Natanz or Isfahan, cities where these nuclear facilities are located, are hit by such a nuclear tactical weapon?
Well, the repercussions could go well beyond Iran. We at the UCS and also the National Academy of Sciences have made detailed studies of the consequence of using nuclear weapons in Iran, or anywhere for that matter, but specifically in Iran, against a deeply buried site, which is the command site, for example. And you can't do that, no matter what anybody tells you. Everybody agrees, including the weapon labs, incidentally, that you can't do that without having a fairly big nuclear explosion, which will produce a great amount of dirt thrown up into the air with the radioactive fallout. And it depends then on the weather conditions, but you can certainly have weather conditions where a radioactive cloud would go from Iran and go all the way out to Pakistan and India. So it could hit some of major cities and produce enormous casualties, and the National Academy has put out a careful study last year which says that casualties could range up to the hundreds of thousands. I mean, fatalities could range up to the hundreds of thousands, depending on the weather. So that would be one consequence. The other consequence, I think, would be that we're very vulnerable to Iran. Iran is one of the bad things about Iran is that they really are a state that fosters terrorism. Iraq really wasn't. Saddam Hussein did not engage, despite what the administration said, did not foster terrorism. But Iran sure does. So there's no reason to not expect retaliation in form of terrorism, both in the Middle East and possibly, I think, plausibly here.
Does the U.S. threat of using nuclear weapons to destroy Iran's capacity to make their own weapons, doesn't that send a double message, or maybe the reverse message, that you better get this weapon or you'll be attacked?
Oh, I agree with you. It does. I mean, we're up a creek without a paddle. It's not. There's no question. We have a very weird policy. We have the largest conventional, most powerful conventional forces in the world. And yet we say we must have nuclear weapons as an integral part of our military posture, more so now than ever before. And on the other hand, we're telling people it's not in your interest to have nuclear weapons. Much weaker states, it's a bad thing for you to get them. It's not in your national interest. And in this instance in particular, especially when you combine it with Korea, North Korea, you know, we've sort of relaxed about North Korea in a certain sense. We don't threaten them that much anymore because they now have claimed and probably do have some nuclear weapons. So we've made it very clear that, as far as I'm concerned, to Iran, that they should get nuclear weapons. And now that we're threatening them, you better redouble your efforts to get them, because that's the only way you're going to get us out of your threatening you. I think this administration, when it came in, wanted not to have any dealings with these rogue states, but you got to deal with them. I mean, it's unpleasant. I understand that, but you do have to deal with them. You have to, and you probably have to give them some kind of an assurance that if they stop their nuclear program and do it in a verifiable manner, that they've stopped it, that they will get something in return. We've done that with Pakistan. We've done it with India, and we've done it de facto. We haven't really said so in writing, but clearly we've done that with North Korea. We have to face the fact that we're going to have to do that with Iran. We're going to get them to stop, which I think is essential. We have to give something in return.
That was Dr. Kurt Gottfried, chairman of the Union of Concerned Scientists. Contact the union by calling area code 202-331-5420. Or visit their website at www.ucsusa.org. In early April, Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald filed court documents revealing that indicted former Chief of Staff to the Vice President, Louis Libby, testified that Dick Cheney had told him that President Bush personally authorized the release of classified intelligence in July 2003 to refute critics of his administration's rationale for war. Mr. Bush's admission that he declassified the CIA's national intelligence estimate to counter public doubts about White House assertions regarding Saddam Hussein's nuclear weapons program contradicts the president's earlier statements. Mr. Bush had previously deplored the leaks and stated that he did not know who in his administration had revealed the classified information. Fitzgerald continues his investigation into who in the White House leaked the identity of covert CIA agent Valerie Plame, wife of Joseph Wilson, a former ambassador who had publicly challenged the president's assertion that Iraq had sought uranium from the African nation of Niger. Although the court documents do not allege that the president was directly involved in the outing of Plame, Mr. Bush's authorization to disclose the CIA's secret analysis to reporters set in motion Libby's disclosure of Plame's identity. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with investigative reporter Robert Parry about the special prosecutor's investigation and the legal jeopardy that President Bush and Vice President Cheney may face as a result of their efforts to discredit Joseph Wilson.
Clearly, there's jeopardy here. And under normal circumstances, and if it were not the president and vice president, you'd expect these people to be rolled up in this investigation. Clearly, they had a hand in it. Clearly, they tried to mislead investigators. A lot depends on what Bush said when he was interviewed. He was interviewed on June 24th, 2004 by Fitzgerald. If Bush continued with the pattern that he'd set in September of 2003 of offering this highly misleading statement that, oh, he doesn't know anything, and gee, he wishes everybody who might know something would come forward. If he continued that in this 70-minute interview in 2004, he could conceivably be in serious jeopardy. Now, he may have, since that interview has never been released, Bush is refusing to rediscuss it at this point. If he's more forthcoming there, he might have been able to protect himself from a clear violation of the law in terms of misleading a prosecutor. Cheney also was interviewed by Fitzgerald, and it's not clear how forthcoming he was. But both of them conceivably would be vulnerable both to the larger question of being part of this effort to disclose the identity of a CIA officer who was undercover. But secondly, they could be implicated in the same kinds of things that Libby faces, the obstruction of justice, perjury, and so forth, although their statements were not under oath, but they would still be vulnerable to charges that they lied to a federal prosecutor or investigator. So that, you know, it's conceivable that they would both be in trouble. It's from reading between the lines of Fitzgerald's court filing of a couple of weeks ago, it would seem that Cheney is more on his radar scope than Bush at this point. But that's somewhat supposition, just based on the kind of language and the kind of phrasing and the focus that filing had. But conceivably both.
It seems to me, looking in retrospect, that the White House was very successful in keeping this story out of the news before the 2004 presidential election, thereby taking it off the table until after people voted and then reelected President Bush. Do you view this as a concerted strategy to do exactly that, to just take this off the table for the election?
Yeah, sure. I think keeping that under wraps is very important. And it's similar to what you saw in 1972 after when the Watergate break-in occurred on, was the second break-in, the one where the burglars were caught, occurs on June 17th, 1972. And the key element of the effort by the Nixon administration from there to the election was to dismiss the importance, the significance, and the facts surrounding the Watergate break-ins. You dial it forward to 2004, you have an administration similarly trying to keep the wraps on a potential important criminal matter until after the voters have cast their ballots. And it's very tough after that to do much because, although Nixon was eventually forced from office by 1974, it was not a pleasant experience for the nation or for the certainly the Washington community to go through that, and there's a real hesitancy to put the nation back through that kind of ordeal. So once you get past the election, there's a lot of pressure just to sort of let this go and maybe focus on some lesser figures of someone like a Libby and not have it go up the chain of command to Cheney or Bush, because that would begin some form of constitutional crisis.
Do you see this current spate of scandals surrounding the Bush administration as indeed as worse than Watergate? And will this eventually lead to indictments of Vice President Cheney and, depending on the midterm elections in November, maybe some very concerted efforts in the House of Representatives to start talking about impeachment?
The consequences of the deceptions around the Iraq War are arguably far worse than Watergate. And then on top of that, you have many of the same corrosive aspects toward the democracy. Wiretapping, Bush asserting plenary powers of the chief executive, that means basically unlimited powers. He's claimed the right to lock up people that he chooses without trial.
So these are rather dramatic steps that were way beyond anything Nixon ever thought of or did. So I think there's a case here. Whether or not the American people choose it, I guess the way we'll know that is how they act during the November of 2006 elections. Right now, you can't really envision politically the Republican Congress taking action against Bush. Cheney may be more vulnerable in terms of possible removal from office. It's not clear, you know, whether or not if Fitzgerald chooses to indict. This law is rather unclear, but because it hasn't happened too many times. But it seems that you can indict vice presidents. It's harder to indict a president. You then have to sort of put it into the impeachment process, which is more political. So I think it really depends on what the American people want, and they sort of have to assert themselves more clearly now that they're armed with more of the information.
That was investigative journalist Robert Parry, winner of the George Polk Award for National Reporting. He is the author of Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. Read his columns online at www.consortiumnews.com. As Americans filed their tax returns in mid-April, most probably didn't have a very specific idea of exactly where their money goes. That's the job of the National Priorities Project, based in Northampton, Massachusetts. The organization explains the impact of federal policies on state and local governments. Every year, the group's researchers do a rigorous analysis of the federal budget to see which areas have fared well and which have not. This year, the project found that the military's share of income tax dollars has risen by 20% since 2000, while the share of spending for job training, environmental protection, housing, and veterans benefits have all dropped. The rise in Pentagon spending is a consequence of the nearly 70% increase in military outlays. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Anita Dench, research director of the National Priorities Project. She explains where U.S. federal tax dollars are being spent on both military and non-military programs.
When we break down your income tax dollar, what we found this year was that 29 cents out of every income tax dollar will go for the military.
Is that for current expenditures? What about past spending on the military?
That's for current expenditures. We might look at, for example, what share of the interest, you know, might be attributed to the military. 19 cents out of every income tax dollar pays for interest payments on the debt, something many people find quite surprising that such a large share of their income tax dollar is going just to make the interest payments on the debt. We've done a historical analysis in order to portion out what might be attributed to military, and our analysis came up with that 9 out of the 19 cents could be attributed to past military spending.
So that's 38 cents on the dollar.
Of course, that 38 cents does not include veterans benefits. That's another 4 cents out of every income tax dollar.
So that's 42 cents of every tax dollar. How does that compare with military expenditures of, say, 5 years ago? I assume it's gone up a lot.
Yes. Military outlays have gone up tremendously over the last 5 years. Of course, the Iraq War, as an active military operation, is very expensive. The war in Afghanistan, less so. But there also is, aside from those military operations, there's been a general increase in military spending. So what that means when we look at, say, the year 2000, in the year 2000, 24 cents out of your income tax dollar went to the military. So that's quite a large share still, but now we're looking at 29 cents out of your income tax dollar. So a rise from 24 cents to 29 cents, which is about a 20% increase. In general, the federal spending has increased over the last 5 years. Some parts of the budget more so than others. Some parts have actually been cut, but the total budget itself has increased. And that's in part because we see large areas of the of the budget, such as the military, have gone up by quite considerable amounts. Another area of domestic spending that has gone up is education. However, just to give that some context, even though education spending has gone up over the last 5 years and its share of your income tax dollar has also increased, we're still only talking about 4 cents out of every income tax dollar you pay. So it's actually quite a small part of your income tax dollar.
And this is, you're referring to federal outlays for education?
Federal spending for education. Of course, what we know is that most education spending is actually accounted for by state spending and local spending.
And what about areas where there have been actual cuts?
Well, some areas, as far as looking at a decline in the share of your income tax dollar, we see a very small decline in veterans' benefits. Of course, veterans' benefits in general has gone up. It just hasn't gone up at the pace of hasn't quite matched the increase that the overall budget has gone. Housing is a smaller share. The environment is a smaller share. Job training is a smaller share. These are all areas where the portion of your income tax dollar is falling.
It's tricky when people talk about cuts and the people making the cuts say they're not really cuts, they're just a smaller increase, but it's still more than in the previous budget. Have there been any actual reductions in funding for any areas of the budget over the past 5 years?
Spending on the environment has been cut over the past 5 years. Spending on community development has been cut. However, in this particular case, when we're looking at, you know, we're filling out our taxes for 2005, and so we're looking at the spending in 2005, and what we find is that community development has actually increased, but only because of spending that happened because of Hurricane Katrina and Rita. Otherwise, if we remove that natural disaster from the analysis, we'd see a decline in community development over the past few years.
That was Anita Dench of the National Priorities Project. For more information, call area code 413-584-9556. Visit the project's website at www.nationalpriorities.org to learn about where your state and community rank in terms of dollars sent to Washington and services received. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Phil Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Gates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is growing and hoping for your membership and participation. www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. For our last show of April, we'll continue to explore environmental issues, this time with a focus on food. We leave you now with this quote by Wendell Berry. The world cannot be discovered by a journey of miles, no matter how long, but only by a spiritual journey, a journey of 1 inch, very arduous and humbling and joyful, by which we arrive at the ground at our feet and learn to be at home.